Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. For the third year in a row, the Iowa House yesterday took up water quality legislation. And by noon, the bill finally passed on a mostly partisan vote. The legislation is now on its way to the governor. It will spend millions of dollars for water quality improvement projects over the next decade. But the final version pitted farm groups against environmentalists, and there was some bitter debate. Iowa's Nutrient Reduction Strategy is a research-based plan to reduce nutrients in Iowa's waterways by 45%. Nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus pollute Iowa's drinking water and create algae blooms that make the lakes unswimmable. Spirit Lake Republican John Wills says the bill that finally passed assures there will be money to carry out that strategy.
The bill builds upon the successful implementation of the Iowa Nutrient Reduction Strategy and provides for long-term and sustainable funding. This is just the beginning, not the end.
The measure spends $286 million over 12 years to improve practices on the farm and in cities and towns. The money would be diverted from existing sources that currently pay for schools, infrastructure, and other priorities. And that's a problem for minority Democrats.
I'm asking myself, why this? Why now?
That was Mason City Democrat Sharon Steckman. She said Republican leaders made sure the water bill went to the top of the debate agenda when the budget isn't even balanced yet. Steckman and most Democrats favored a bill that also would have diverted money away from other priorities. They say in their bill there was more to ensure that the dollars were targeted where they will improve water the most. Dubuque Democrat Charles Eisenhart said the alternative bill would have made more accountability possible with several features.
Goals, timelines, measurement, monitoring of water quality in stream, public reporting of results.
The bill that passed instead initially came from Governor Branstad's office. It has the backing of other major farm groups, as well as Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey. Boone Republican Chris Baltimore was one of a handful of GOP lawmakers who opposed the measure.
I did not come down here to check a box. And just because water quality, the words water quality are in the title of a bill, does not make me proud to vote for it so that I can put it on a postcard when I go campaign.
Critics say the bill makes individual landowners less accountable for any money they receive to improve farm practices. Baltimore singled out the Farm Bureau for what he called its aggressive lobbying and for, in his words, being unwilling to compromise. Representative Wills called the lobbying immaterial. The Iowa Environmental Council said neither version of the bill provided enough money to address what they estimate is a $4 to $6 billion problem. One lawmaker called it a trickle in a bucket. The council put out a statement calling the bill that gained final passage an irresponsible use of taxpayer funds, with no assurance of actually cleaning up lakes and streams. However, Representative Wills said Iowa is already making progress getting nutrients out of the water.
We've already, in the last 5 years with the nutrient reduction strategy, 83% of our rivers and streams are monitored with water monitor devices, and they've shown that we've already reduced our nutrient load by 1% just in the 5 years.
In her condition of the state speech, Governor Reynolds called the legislation monumental. After it passed, she issued a statement calling it an important step in making Iowa's lakes, rivers, and streams cleaner. She'll announce the time for a signing ceremony at a later date. In her condition of the state speech, Governor Reynolds called the legislation monumental. After it passed, she issued a statement calling it an important step in making Iowa's lakes, rivers, and streams cleaner. She'll announce the time for a signing ceremony at a later date. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The University of Iowa Healthcare Center recently found a way to greatly expand its clinical trial opportunities. The center joined the TrinetX Global Health Research Network, which provides access to industry-sponsored clinical trial opportunities. David Fusari is the chief technical officer with TrinetX, which is based in Boston, Massachusetts, and he explains how the whole thing works.
Through the TrinetX platform, users at pharmaceutical companies can look at de-identified patient information to try to understand patients in various populations at these hospitals across the United States and globally, whether they exist and what kind of diseases do they have and what other kinds of comorbidities they may present. So when they're designing a clinical trial, they want to understand what that population looks like. Once they are ready to operationalize a trial, they can reach out through our platform and connect to those organizations that have patients that fit the profile that are needed, and as a result, be able to set up and operationalize that trial at those sites that have an interest in conducting those particular trials for their patients and in support of their community.
So hospitals like the U of I hospital, then through the network, they can find people for their clinical trials that fit their needs.
That's exactly correct. And they know that these patients actually exist in the real world, because quite often when a clinical trial is designed, it may be designed in a way that is perhaps idealistic, and trying to identify patients that actually fit that profile can be very difficult to find. So making sure that your trial criteria are realistic is an important characteristic of the platform, and bringing real-world data to power those insights.
Are these clinical trials for a wide range of research interests? Are they focused in certain areas like, say, cancer?
We do not consider ourselves to be therapeutic area specific. So the clinical trials that we see coming through our platform run the gamut from oncology to cardiovascular to hematologic, and then also getting down to very rare diseases. We find that in our network, especially because we have many academic-oriented medical organizations that are part of our network, that we have a broad representation of patients with rare diseases, which are very hard to find.
I saw from one of the press releases that you're excited to see quick results that UI has experienced since joining the network.
Sure. When UI joined, they had forecasted perhaps seeing one or two, maybe even three clinical trial opportunities be sent to their institution through our platform. And now they've received already 40, over 40, and that was a rate much higher than they anticipated. So they are getting much more exposure to clinical trials opportunities where their patient population may be candidates for those clinical trials. So that is a growth that they were not expecting to see. And as a result, they're really seeing this inflow of new opportunities. In addition, our platform will also allow them to have more users within their organization support their own internal research activities, because they get to use our platform for their own purposes as well. So their internal users can use sort of the advanced and dynamic nature of our tooling.
This must be invaluable for a teaching and research hospital like UI.
We believe so. Now, with some of the newer capabilities we're rolling out, the ability to collaborate with other institutions as well across our network, we believe that one of the core reasons we've attracted so many top-name institutions like University of Iowa and many others across the United States.
It's almost like an information superhighway for research.
That's one good way to characterize it. It is. We pride ourselves on all the security and governance characteristics of this superhighway. People put a lot of trust in us in order to build a network like this, where others can gain access to data in a way, but making sure that it remains secure and reliable. We have to be able to scale this platform to make sure that everybody is getting sort of good throughput and response time. But it is very much becoming and very much like a superhighway. I like your analogy for that. But as we continue to grow TrinetX and we continue to grow globally, I think what we've seen at Iowa is really a a beacon for how you execute and become a member of the Trinetics network. They were incredibly effective at getting live and deployed on our platform. Their ability to adopt it and make use of it internally within their own operations. They have been a tremendous organization to work with, and we look forward to a long and continued collaboration and working relationship with them. They're an outstanding organization.
That was David Fusari of Trinetics, a Boston-based global health network that connects researchers conducting clinical trials. The University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics has been working with the company for the past 6 months. Dr. Patricia Winokur is the executive dean for the UI Carver College of Medicine. She says the collaboration has been invaluable for conducting clinical trials.
So I would say that we have great potential with our electronic medical record, and we've had ways of being able to query the data in our electronic medical record, but the Trinetics program that overlays that information is really very user-friendly, and it's really designed to do something that our other systems weren't designed to do, and that was to also interface us at the University of Iowa with people outside of the University of Iowa. So that's a huge advantage because it's putting Iowa on the map, and it's telling people that we have great researchers, populations that can participate in research, and it brings opportunities into our institution.
How many researchers, or maybe how many research projects, if you know, just in general, do you have going on at once?
So going on at once, we have really hundreds of clinical trials going on. They can be anywhere from simply analyses of past data. And so we have students or trainees that go into the databases, and they try and understand that in the past, how did people do when they had a certain disease and were given a certain treatment? So it's called retrospective data. We also have prospective data that can be either just observing how things happen, or they can be interventions where we're actually providing a new therapy for a disease or even a new device that might be implanted to, you know, regulate their heart rhythm, or a new joint device that helps with someone who needs a total knee replacement. And so really it's hundreds of projects are going on all the time, but there are very different types of projects going on.
Having access to populations around the country, does that make it a lot easier for you to conduct these clinical trials and get to some results?
So absolutely. So if we are simply participating in someone else's trial, it says that the University of Iowa has a patient population and we have a researcher that is interested in that type of research. And so we can participate with other people. Or this program also is very helpful as we are designing our own trials and also looking for participants from outside of the University of Iowa. So we could go in and find that Northwestern or University of Minnesota or others have a population and could partner with us to get the trial done faster and involve more patients, so it's a more meaningful trial.
I was wondering how long it takes from a clinical trial to actually using a treatment.
So that's a great question, and that's one of the reasons that I think this company got into this business, and it takes a long time from the time that a drug is discovered in a test tube, essentially, to getting it out to being used in medical care. A lot of that is the time it takes to perform the clinical trials that end up telling the FDA that this is a safe option for a patient population, and it's an effective therapy for a patient population. And so anything that we can do to speed the time that it takes to enroll patients into oftentimes very complex studies helps get these products to FDA for a decision faster, and if it passes the FDA's scrutiny, into the general population for use.
Do you think this is going to be the future of clinical trials?
You know, I think this is a tool for helping get this type of research done more efficiently. There are many other things that can be done to help with the clinical trials process, and not so much drug discovery, but drug validation, I would say, or new product validation. So this is a great step forward, and it's actually had quite an impact here at the University of Iowa. But there are many other things that we can do to try and speed this pipeline from discovery into actual use.
What kind of impact has it had at the University of Iowa?
So we started, we essentially turned on Trinetics about 6 to 8 months ago. And in the first 6 months, we were approached to participate in 40 different trials. And so that's 40 trials that are offering our patients here at the University of Iowa options that we might not have been able to offer them before. And again, it goes to that concept that, you know, sometimes I think people forget about Iowa, and anything we can do to get our name and our reputation out is a good thing. And the other thing, once we've participated in trials, the companies learn that our patient populations are some of the best in the country. When we have our patients commit to doing a clinical trial or commit to anything, they follow through and they stick to it to the end. They make the visits that are needed to get clean data. And that's what the clinical trials need to make the best decisions about that drug or device or whatever we're studying.
So this is really a new kind of model for doing clinical trials.
The company is almost a little bit of a middleman, and I think they've done a very nice job of protecting privacy for the patient populations. This data is de-identified, and you can do kind of queries without kind of jeopardizing that confidentiality that we have promised to our patients. And then we have very strict processes that we go through if we end up wanting to try and contact a specific person to see if they're interested in a trial. And this company has respected those processes very well. And I think that's an important concept. We have med students that have been trained to look at Trinetics. Again, what it does is it allows them to understand, you know, sometimes how it's an interesting way of teaching them about electronic data. They can get in and understand patient populations, you know, where a disease is most prevalent in an age population. They could go in and understand, is it more men or women that have this disease? They could go in and understand, you know, of our patients that have rheumatoid arthritis, how many of them also have diabetes or something. They can play with the data without, again, jeopardizing any confidentiality, and learn how you might set up a clinical trial and how you might look for patient populations. So it's actually been a tool that can be very helpful for them.
That was Dr. Patricia Winokur, the Executive Dean of the UI Carver College of Medicine, talking about the school's collaboration with the Trinetics Global Health Company in terms of clinical trials. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. There has been a large number of books written about Little House author Laura Ingalls Wilder that take a look at her life and work. Now, horticulturalist, teacher, and writer Marta McDowell has written about Laura and her relationship with the landscapes of her books. Her book is called The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, The Frontier Landscapes That Inspired the Little House Books. McDowell says the book itself was inspired in part by the huge reaction to Pioneer Girl, the annotated autobiography of Wilder that was printed 4 years ago. McDowell says she realized she would have to visit each Little House site to get a feel for the landscapes and the plants that grow there.
You know, you can do a lot from the internet these days. You can get on Google Maps, you can look at, you know, sort of street level views, you can do 360, but it's not like being there.
Exactly.
I had traveled a lot in my life between New Jersey and Illinois, and very little across the Mississippi. You know, it's like, you know, that was just where we stopped. That was, you know, and then if I was going to California, I'd get on a plane. So that was really a, you know, my own sort of wagon ride, which was really, really interesting and gave me a great appreciation for many of the beautiful places out on the Great Plains that I had been missing. So that was fun.
Well, you know, starting in the beginning of the book, looking at Wisconsin and the little house in the big woods, it, you know, a lot of people have talked about the fairy tale sort of setting of this book. It seems like the most wonderful magic place with the trees and the animals and all of that. But you talk about that, but you also talk about how hard it was for, you know, a family like the Ingalls to live there in the forest and constantly be grubbing out trees and how much work it really was.
Well, yes, if anyone has ever grubbed out roots, even of any substantial shrub, you know, that is really heavy labor. And yes, they had, you know, they had draft horses and things, but you're talking about really big trees and not much in terms of equipment to do it. So it was not easy. You know, they got part of their living off of the forest, you know, the animals. You know, Pa was a great hunter. But still, you know, it was not easy. I wonder if I would have made it in that kind of life, you know.
And yet there are so many kind of wonderful flowers and beautiful things to see, and Laura seemed to be able to rest the magic of the forest and put that in the book, and you know, that's still there to see, right?
Yes, and you know, they had the advantage, you know, you could view it as a negative, but if you view it as an advantage, you say, well, you were living very close to the land, right? You were very close to nature. You were in it. You know, your shelter did not seal you off in the same way, and you were using the forest as a much deeper resource than we, you know, now we view it as mostly a place to visit, you know, unless you're still in the lumber business in some way. You know, it's a place to camp and maybe hunt or fish or just take a walk. I think one thing that Wilder did that really struck me as I was sort of re-looking at her works from an adult point of view is she left us a paper trail, you know, kind of a document of that time before America was completely settled. You know, I mean, yes, there are still wild places, but they're more in the line of places that we preserve, as opposed to, you know, that frontier. She was at the end, and she really caught it in such an amazing way, given that she didn't write these until she was much older.
Yeah, that was something that she said, I believe, in a couple of interviews, that she wanted to be able to get all of this down before she got too old and couldn't remember it.
Yeah. And, you know, if you think about the writers who left that sort of feeling for us, there aren't many, at least not many that kind of made it to the pantheon, if you will. I guess, you know, Willa Cather comes to mind. But there aren't too many.
As you go on through the book and you get to Farmer Boy and Almanzo, her husband, and how he grew up in way, way near the Canadian border in northern New York, the family is so different. The landscape is very different. And people have talked a lot about how this family seems to be much better off, and the tons and tons of food they grow and the tons of food that's always on the table.
Yeah, and, you know, that must have really made an impression on the adult Wilder, Laura Ingalls Wilder, because that part of the book is really shined up, right? It's burnished so that it catches the highlight. It catches the reader, right? You know, it's like this little boy who just kind of revels in food. And I guess what struck me was, this was entirely done from stories, because she never visited Malone. Her daughter did while she was in the process of writing the book. So she kind of, in a way, sends her daughter on a research trip, you know, to verify things and talk to people. But she does it translating someone else's stories. You know, it's almost like one of those books where it says, you know, this is a book by such and such a famous person. And, you know, it's like, this is a book by Almanzo Wilder and Laura Ingalls Wilder. And I guess it says to me, wow, those were times when people really told stories much more, you know, again, much more than we do today. It was sort of like what you did. You told stories and you told them and retold them until they really stood out as something you remembered.
Yeah, and in Farmer Boy, there are so many scenes of them, the family working the land, growing things, and he's sort of described as a little, almost like a little soldier fighting back the weeds and, you know, fighting the good fight, being the farmer.
And I think it was the way most people looked at it, like, we're going to conquer the continent. And if you have to eke out a living wherever you happen to land, you have to kind of gear yourself up, right? Give yourself the pep talk. We're going to go out and, you know, and soldier away.
You know, in the book, when you move on to the various prairies, like Kansas, Minnesota, South Dakota, and then she changes the landscape completely, which she doesn't write about in her children's book. She moves down to Missouri, which is a very different place. You know, she mentions, and you mentioned too, about how, you know, a prairie isn't a prairie isn't a prairie. All those prairies are very different places, aren't they?
Yeah, and that was a surprise to me. So, you know, again, having grown up and now live on the East Coast, you know, I drove across with my parents, but what I remember is not prairie. You know, I remember driving through farmland. And so this was really the first time that I had sort of concentrated trips of visiting different places that we term prairie. You know, probably someone with a lot of, you know, expertise on that landscape would have different words for them, but you know, that's how I knew them. So that was quite interesting to me to see the differences, you know, in the different places they lived. And she clearly recognized that, even though, you know, she wasn't a scientist. Here's a woman; she essentially had an eighth grade education, plus, you know, the reading and the life learning and all the other things that she did through her life. But she was clearly observant, and I really do feel like it isn't a stretch to classify her as a nature writer. you know, it's not something that she particularly concentrated on, but it's certainly there.
It does seem like the family got a lot of joy out of nature, especially the Ingalls family, because they didn't have much.
Right. So there were always flowers. There were flowers in all of the books of, you know, them picking flowers and her mother arranging flowers. And a lot of pleasure that came out of that. You know, to the extent that Laura never was a flower gardener. I mean, one thing that was sort of stunning when I started really researching. So, you know, this book, again, it happened kind of through the back door. My editor said, "Are you interested?" I did a little research. I wrote an outline. I put together a little proposal. And, you know, we sent it in. And so that was all good. And then I really started in to do the research. And so if you're a Wilder scholar, you start at the Hoover Library in West Branch, Iowa.
Right.
Because that's where papers are. So, you know, papers, photographs, etc. So out we go to Iowa, and, you know, I start going through the photographs. And there is literally one picture of Laura in the garden. I mean, that's kind of it. It's one of her picking peas. There is one of her, I think, standing in front of a cornfield, but she's not actually working. You know, she's not in the garden. So, you know, at that point, I guess, so this is like day one of research, and I'm going, uh-oh, now what? I just assumed there would be other pictures of her out in the garden, and, not so.
You know, for me, it really harkened back to some of the things I've read other people have written about the family, and they're, you know, they seem to have this belief in this manifest destiny and always going west and conquering the land. But, you know, the sad irony is that her father was always wanting to move on because when he got somewhere and more people came, it was ruined and he didn't want to be in a place so settled. But he was part of the problem.
I guess he wasn't alone. And I was sort of puzzled when I started out on this, thinking, well, so he goes through all this effort, and he finally kind of settles on a claim, right? And, you know, he stakes his claim, he proves up, and then he doesn't stay there. I thought, that's really strange. But then the more I read about homesteading, the more I realized that Charles Ingalls wasn't alone in that, you know, that many, many people would stake claims with the intention of essentially flipping, you know, now we call it flipping.
Right.
You know, flipping the property. And, you know, I think he was sort of two minds. I think that Pa always kind of hoped that he'd hit a bonanza year and really make it, you know, that somehow he'd have a great harvest when the price was high and, you know, catapult himself into a kind of a different social class. But I don't think that he, I don't know, you know, nothing's really much is written by Pa that survives. I mean, there was one thing that Almanzo wrote he answered a survey for his daughter when she was writing one of her pioneer novels. And it almost broke my heart because he said at one point something like, you know, my life has entirely been a disappointment or a series of disappointments. And it's like, oh my goodness, what a sad thing to say.
You know, I agree. I remember reading that. And then I thought back to, you know, his childhood when he was just a little boy and seemingly everything was really great and his dad had a wonderful farm and, you know, he was respected and everything was going wonderful for them.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, like things don't always work out. I will say, you know, in spite of their hard times, it seems like they, you know, they held on to their value system and that kept them going. You know, they certainly always worked hard, including, you know, you have to say, well, Laura Ingalls Wilder. She really embarks on fiction writing when she's in her 60s, and, you know, and continues kind of delivering these books and, you know, kind of for the rest of her life, including writing things that weren't, you know, like the first 4 years where it wasn't published during her life. You go, well, she wrote that just to write it. You know, not for any feelings that she would be paid for it, but she was driven to write.
The books are about men conquering the soil and that sort of being how, you know, the country is built and how people, families are held together and you make a living. Really, it was, you know, the living in that family was made by women writing, not by the land.
That's absolutely true. You know, that's where they really finally got financial stability.
That was Marta McDowell, author of The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder, the frontier landscape that inspired the Little House books. McDowell is also known for her books about authors like Beatrix Potter and Emily Dickinson as gardeners. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The South Dakota Chorale, a professional choral organization based in Sioux Falls, has been nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Choral Performance for its latest recording, Tyburg Masses. The Grammy Awards will be presented January 28th. The music of Marcel Tyburg, a church musician and composer killed in the Holocaust, has only recently been discovered. Siouxland Public Media's Allie Carson talks with the chorale's chair, Heath Weber, about the nomination and the music that inspired it.
So there is a concert coming up on Friday called Baltic Prayers, and that's going to be at Morningside College with the South Dakota Chorale. But there's also a big piece of news.
That's true.
That the South Dakota Chorale has a Grammy nomination, or actually three nominations.
Three, yeah. It's pretty great. Pretty great. We have one for Best Choral Performance, one for Best Surround Sound, and one for Best Engineering Classical. So our chances are good, which is fun. We'll see. Of course, we're the most proud of the Best Choral Performance. But we're not sneezing at the other two.
Yeah. And this is for the Tyburg Project.
Correct.
And can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it was a pretty fascinating project. The music that we performed were two masses by a fellow by the name of Marcel Tyburg. And he was lost in the Holocaust. And the story behind these two masses was that the night before he was captured, he brought all of his friends in a dimly lit church balcony and played his symphonies and his masses on an organ, and then gave the music to his friends, and it scattered the four directions. And resurfaced again in an attic in upstate New York, and some of his symphonies were getting some playtime in Europe, and for whatever reason, this person said to our conductor, Brian Schmidt, "Hey, I've got these two masses, do you want to take a peek at them?" And so Brian did, and lo and behold, they got transcribed, and we put organ with them, and it became a pretty fantastic experience. So the first time that we performed this music was in Sioux Falls, and then we did it in Minneapolis and Lincoln, and recorded the disc in Lincoln with the Tracker organ down there, which is a fantastic instrument. And we had a pretty fantastic time. And the singers, of course, as the weeks, we were together for 2 weeks, and as those 2 weeks went on, we all had a light bulb moment when we all thought, this is a special project. This is a special thing to think of, you know, our voices giving birth to that music again after so many years. And, you know, I mean, it could have stayed in that attic and it could have never been heard.
Yeah. Yeah. What really strikes me is that, you know, he had a friend who thought that these were worth saving.
Right.
And that they were passed down to the friend's son, and then, you know, that's how they end up in this attic, and they resurface. And when somebody presents you with that kind of project, to me, the only answer is yes.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And to you, I mean, what was that light bulb moment, as you say, where, you know, was it just like a feeling, or...
You know, I told our conductor that I hadn't had that kind of feeling singing in an ensemble since I was in college. And the idea of 28 people really focused on one thing and really committed to making beautiful music, it's unlike anything I can describe. It's very similar to a really excellent team or... a football team, basketball team. But because it is so intensely personal, because it's our voices, it takes on a very different feeling. It takes on a totally different connotation because it's so, so intrinsically motivated for it to be a special experience, not only for us, but for the audience as well.
Yeah. So when did you find out that the T-Bird Project had these three Grammy nominations, and what did you think after you found out?
It was pretty funny, actually, because I was on Facebook and I looked at the at the Facebook post from Brian, the conductor, and I thought, well, a Grammy? What in the world? And, you know, kept refreshing and called Brian and said, Are we really getting a Grammy? And he said, we're certainly up. We're in the top five. So then there's a lot of hooting and hollering, and called my parents, called my sister and brother-in-law and nephews, and maybe danced a little jig in the office at Morningside. And it was that way kind of all over the country. People were just overjoyed because we knew what a great thing had happened. And so everyone else clearly experienced that as well, who listened. So,
yeah. And how did your family respond to it?
my father was maybe the funniest, because he said an expletive, and I was like, well, Dad, and he's like, well, that's great. My mother thought it was absolutely fantastic as well. So they were pretty jazzed. My nephews, those sweet boys, asked me to autograph their CDs that they got for Christmas. They thought that was pretty neat. I was like, well, of course your Uncle Heath will autograph your CDs.
Yeah, and those may just go up in value very soon. We'll see. I don't want to jinx it for you. Because it is, I mean, you still do have to sit here and wait for...
It's true. Next Sunday. So,
okay. Yeah.
The 28th? Yeah, 28th.
Well, and before that, you have the concert on the 26th at Morningside. So you have to come back down to earth.
It's true.
Do
but
the job.
I'll tell you, this music that we're preparing for this Baltic Prayers concert is, it's going to be hard to come back down to earth, as you said. It's really, there are some just stunning pieces. Ethereal, Eric Eschenvaltz is a composer that's gained some significant prominence over the past couple of years. He has a tune, O Salutaris Ostia, that is stunning, and we'll be singing that piece, as well as a tune called In Paradisum, which is just unreal. And some beautiful composers that I hadn't heard of from the Baltic region and some Norwegian composers. So a really beautiful set of music, introspective, and as Brian said, there are some healing aspects to this program, some opportunity for you to look inside a little bit and truly let some music just wash over you.
I've been talking to Heath Weber with the Grammy-nominated South Dakota Chorale. The Sioux Falls-based group of professional musicians will be performing at Morningside College on Friday at 7:30 p.m. And then on Sunday, they'll find out if their work on Tiberg Masses brings home a Grammy. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Allie Carson.